It's time to head out on the front porch on KFRM. Grab your favorite drink, sit back, relax, and enjoy the conversation on the front porch.
Hi, this is Kyle Bauer. It's my honor and pleasure today to be visiting with Mati Friedman. He is the author of a book that was just released March the 5th called Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. I've always been a huge fan of Israel all my life. They have struggled to create a country, hold a country together in the midst of enemies all around them. And then I got this notice about Mati's new book, and I thought it'd be a great way to explore the history and then talk about all the research that he had to do for this book. Thank you for being with me, Mati.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as we set this up, I'm afraid there's a lot of people who don't understand the history of Israel, and but let's start with your background to start with, and where you grew up and how you came to be doing what you do.
Sure. I was born in Toronto, Canada, and when I was 17, I went to spend a year in Israel. It was supposed to be just a year between high school and college, and I went to work in agriculture on a kibbutz, which is a kind of communal farm, and I spent a year milking cows, and I just loved it. I didn't want to go home at the end of the year, and I stayed, and that was 23 years ago. That was 1995. So I ended up staying in Israel, and I became a citizen, which in Israel means triggering the draft after high school. There's a compulsory military service, so I ended up in the military there for almost 3 years, and then went to university and began working as a journalist, and then began writing books and got married and had a few kids, and I live in Jerusalem, and that's the very short version of my life story.
Well, I was born in 58, and Israel started more or less in treaties that were right after World War II, but it seemed like all of my life they were fighting for their existence, and they were pretty darn good at doing that. You being in the military, compulsory military service, was kind of part of that whole design.
That's right. The country is very small. It's not big enough to allow a volunteer military. So since the beginning of the state, they've drafted men and women out of high school. And it makes for an interesting military. A lot of people in the army who wouldn't probably be there otherwise. It also adds a kind of a social cohesion to the country. When everyone or most people serve in the military, they meet each other, people from different backgrounds, they mix during their military service, and it kind of provides a kind of glue for a country that's made up of many, many different kinds of people with many kind of radically different ideas about what they're doing there. So the army's a very important part of Israeli society from a social perspective, not just from the perspective of national defense, which is obvious.
Of course, all of us that come from the Christian Judeo background think about Israel as being the Holy Land, and I don't think we, though, really appreciate how that Holy Land was carved out after World War II and how it was held. Can you fill us in on some of the back history on that?
Sure. I mean, this should only take 5 or 6 hours.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Listeners will stick with us. After World War I, the Ottoman Empire is carved up by the European powers, and the British take control of a territory that they call Palestine, which is the Holy Land. And they're holding Palestine under a mandate to create a Jewish national home in Palestine. So the kind of homeless and oppressed Jewish populations of Europe and to a lesser extent of the Middle East are offered a national home, a place that can be theirs. And the British set this up in 1917, and then through a few complicated decades, this plan unfolds. There's immigration, there's increased oppression in Europe as the Nazis come to power. Eventually, there's a Holocaust in Europe, and by 1948, there are about 600,000 Jews in the Holy Land, in the British Mandate territory of Palestine. Most of those Jews come from Europe, from Eastern Europe, and they're part of the Zionist movement. the Zionist movement, which believed that the solution to the problems of the Jews across the centuries was to have a state of our own. And in 1947, the United Nations votes to partition the British Mandate territory of Palestine into two states, one for Arabs and one for Jews. And the Arab world rejects that plan, and the Jews accept it. And what unfolds after that is the 1948 war, in which the Jewish population ends up fighting off five Arab armies and creating a state, the State of Israel, which has been around for 71 years.
Well, and that's the part, before, you know, a lot of us aren't old enough to remember that. And quite honestly, most of the world was coming out of World War II. And had their own, if you will, battles to fight, probably didn't have as much significance as people realize. But brand new country, had only been around for a year as a country, maybe two at the most, and was fighting off, like you say, five Arab countries, and one is pretty amazing. But I think that sets the scene for just how fearless fighters and how resolute the Israelis were in retaining their country.
Well, in 1948, that's certainly true, and they had, I think, the most important part of their motivation, the secret of their success in many ways, isn't their weaponry, which is very, very light, and it isn't their military acumen, which is quite amateurish at that time. What they have is desperation. They're desperate. They have nowhere else to go. Their backs are to the Mediterranean, and they have to win. There's no other option. And that, I think, gives them the fuel to win that war with tremendous sacrifice. About 6,000 Jews died in that war out of a population of 600,000. That's 1% of the Jewish population died in the 48 war, which is quite astonishing.
Now, the first war I remember was 67. I was just still only like 10 years old. But by then, over that 20 years, Israel had really built quite a significant army, or had gotten enough tools to put together a state-of-the-art army by then.
That's right. So less than 20 years after 48, you have a war which is known as the Six-Day War. And then by that time, Israel is something different. They've managed to build a very competent military. They've managed to build an excellent air force. At the time, the Americans weren't really in the picture. The main arms supplier was France, and the Israeli pilots were flying French airplanes. And that victory in 67 kind of puts Israel on the map as a military power. And we've been in the post-67 era since then to such an extent that I think it's hard for people to remember what it was like in 1948. So this book, Spies of No Country, takes place in 48, before Israel's a military power, before there is really an Israeli army, before there is an intelligence apparatus, and everything is just kind of chaotic and improvised. And I'm more interested in that time than in the post-67 era, where Israel, at least superficially, has the upper hand.
Well, and that was exactly why I was setting that time period, because really since 67, Israel has dominated every time they have been tested. And they have a huge spying system that has been very, very effective throughout the world. I know has worked well with the U.S. intelligence service, and they live with, if you will, terrorists all around them, all the time, and has kind of taught the world how to do that. I get the impression your book is kind of the beginning of their Mossad.
That's right. I mean, Israel has a mystique about its intelligence services, and there's a whole mythology around the Mossad. But in 1948, when all of this gets going, it's almost pathetic how human it is and how small it is. The Arab section, which is the subject of this book and is one of the seeds of what eventually becomes the Mossad, does not own a camera. So when they need a camera, they have to borrow it from a guy they know. They don't own a radio. So when they're inserted into the Arab world, they have no way initially to communicate, talking about maybe a dozen spies at the beginning of the 48 war, very poorly trained, mostly improvising. Half of them get caught and executed. And if you understand the kind of modest beginnings of what eventually becomes the Mossad and this kind of renowned spy system, it's quite astonishing. It's quite astonishing how different things looked in 1948.
Well, and to make sure everybody fully understands this, I mean, by 48, there was many, many people that were flowing in every day from all over, specifically Europe, to start this country as refugees from the from World War II, and none of them particularly came. None is a bad word. They didn't particularly come as military people. They came as ordinary working folks, and they were required, if you will, to make a defensive situation and defend themselves when that wasn't the skill set they had brought to the country.
That's right. The Jews have no military history. They've been powerless by that time for 2,000 years. It's been 2,000 years since there was Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel. They've been kind of kicked around Europe and the Middle East under majority populations, Christianity and Islam, and they don't have a military history. They don't have military training. They've never done this before. They're making it up as they go along. And what ends up kind of pushing them forward is really that desperation, that understanding that they have no choice. So there are stories about people getting off the boats, Holocaust survivors getting off the boats in 1947, 1948. People with no families, and they were given rifles and a few days of training. They were sent off to win this war.
We're talking today with Mati Friedman. He just has a new book out. It's in the last week or so. Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. We'll be talking about the history of Israel, how its birth, the environment that it was, and how they became, I'm going to call them, a world superpower. Join us after the break for more on the Front Porch. Hi, this is Kyle Bauer. Welcome back to On the Front Porch, visiting today with Mati Friedman. He is the author of a new book out, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. I've always been such a big fan of Israel and how it's able to survive in that terrible, hostile political environment there. And Mati basically has looked at the background on how that happened after World War II and bringing us up to speed today on how that happened. You mentioned that people after World War II, the Jewish people had no history of being a military people, were handed a gun in a few days and expected to guard their country, if you will, defend their brand new country. But I also got the impression after World War II, there was just boatloads and boatloads and trainloads of people coming from Europe. Israel had to be growing exponentially.
That's right. Until the state is declared in May 1948, the British, who control the country and have for 30 years, are keeping out Jewish refugees. And there are British naval ships running a blockade in the Mediterranean to keep out these boatloads of people who are trying to make it to the land of Israel from Europe, Holocaust survivors. As soon as the British pull out in May 1948 and the state is declared, waves of immigration begin to arrive. People who've been kept in displaced persons camps in Europe, Holocaust survivors, people washing up from all kinds of places. And an interesting thing happens that no one had really expected, which is that there are about a million Jews who are native to the Islamic world, mostly Arabic speakers, people in countries like Morocco and Tunisia and Libya and Egypt and Syria and Yemen. And those Jews begin coming in waves to this new state, and this very small country is overwhelmed by immigrants, and it doubles in size within, I think, about 2 years, and then doubles again. And its makeup changes, and the original population that had existed in 1948 is vastly outnumbered within a decade, outnumbered by newcomers. And this poses all kinds of problems. Where do you put these people? There are no homes for them. What language do you speak? Right? You have newcomers who speak Yiddish and Polish and Russian and Arabic and Persian and Kurdish. And how do you communicate? It poses incredible challenges for this new country. But it also gives the country working hands, people who will build it, and fighting hands, people who can serve in the military, which ends up being very important because, to the disappointment of the Jewish leadership, the Arab world does not come to terms with the state of Israel after 1948, which is what they'd expected to happen. They expected to win the war and then see the Arab world say, okay, you know what, let's sign a treaty and move on. That doesn't happen, and the enmity in the Arab world in many ways deepens after 1948, and they understand that they're just going to have to build up militarily to the extent that they can and kind of keep fighting for the country's survival. I'm not sure that anyone expected it to go on 70 years, but it has.
But with that, with those Arab Jews moving into the country, it certainly mixes the color. It's not like the folks from Europe who are a different color. And so you have a mix of Arab background folks, folks from Europe. And so the color, if you will, and the mix in this hostile land is not obvious and evident for people to see them. And that's kind of the basis of some of your book.
That's right. When the state is set up, it's set up by Jews from Europe, and no one really paid much attention to the Jewish community that existed in Islamic countries. And I think many people in the West don't even know that there was a Jewish world in the Middle East that was native to this part of the world. There were about 1 million Jews living in Islamic countries in the 1940s, a fact that many people don't know. Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, was one-third Jewish in the 1940s. So we're talking about a very large, very old Jewish population. Most of those communities had been there before Islam, and many of them had been there before Christianity. The community in Aleppo, Syria, for example, was an ancient community by the time the Second Temple was destroyed in Jerusalem in the year 70 AD. So we're talking about a very old Jewish world that's native to this part of the world. And within a few years, because of state persecution and riots and murder and violence, and also because of a desire to join this Jewish project in the state of Israel, a mix of motivations, that whole world collapses and disappears. And today, in 2019, those communities are completely gone, and most of their descendants live in Israel, and it changes the character of the state. It had been imagined as a kind of European kind of state, and it ends up being much more Middle Eastern in character. So if you come to Israel, as I encourage you to do, and I encourage your listeners to do, and you're standing on a street in Israel, and you look at this street, it doesn't feel like Europe. It feels like the Middle East, and it's not just because Israel has a sizable Arab population, it's because half of the Jewish population in Israel is Middle Eastern in its background, and that's something I think people don't really know about the country, and it's something that it's a point I'm trying to make with this story about four spies who were Jews from Arab countries who put their Arab identities at the service of this new state.
Now, I apologize for my simplicity of understanding, but on the flip side is, prior to 48, or certainly prior to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, that was a Arab country occupied by the Palestinians. I assume it was called Palestine. And then an international treaty carved it out. And the Palestinians didn't necessarily say, oh, that's okay, you can take my ancestral home. I know it's terribly simplistic. Is it more or less accurate?
Well, I mean, it's a very complicated story. So in the years of the Ottoman Empire, which is centuries, the whole area that we're talking about, the Middle East, what we now think of as the Arab world, and also Turkey, they're controlled by the Ottoman Empire. Turkish sultans who sit in Istanbul and rule an Islamic empire across the Middle East. And in the years of the Ottoman Empire, there is no political unit called Palestine. There's a part of the Ottoman Empire which is governed from a few different cities in the area, and it has an old name from the Bible, which is the land of Israel. It has a slightly newer name given by the Romans, which is Palestine. That's the Roman name for the province that existed. The Romans called it Palestine in order to erase the name Judea, which was the earlier name of the province, but the Jews rebelled against Rome one too many times, and the Romans said, okay, forget it. We're going to get rid of these people, and we're going to change the name of the province, and they call it Palestine. So there's a few different names for this place floating around. When the British come in 1917, they beat the Turks. General Allenby famously kind of walks into the old city of Jerusalem through the Jaffa Gate and declares the beginning of British rule in Palestine. They call the territory Palestine. And inside the Palestine mandate that the British are running, they're supposed to set up a national home for Jews. And that sets up a national conflict between Jewish people who see this as their biblical homeland and feel a deep historical connection to the place, and an Arab population, mostly Muslim with a small Christian minority, who has been living there for a long time and obviously isn't happy about this new arrangement. And that's a conflict that's been playing out in different ways for more than 100 years.
Well, and Jerusalem is a holy place for the Muslim world as well.
That's right. Jerusalem, where I live, is a city holy to three religions. You have the Jewish connection, which is the oldest of the three, the Temple Mount, which is, I guess, about a half an hour walk from my house, is the site of the two biblical temples. Important parts of the New Testament, of course, take place on the Temple Mount, and that makes the city holy to Christianity. The story of the Passion takes place in the old city of Jerusalem, and Stations of the Cross are also about a half an hour walk from where I live, and there's a big Christian presence, of course, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and all these sites that are incredibly potent for the Christian world. And then in the 7th century, with the arrival of Arab conquerors, kind of impassioned by a new religion called Islam, they arrive in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem becomes holy to them. And there's a story that's told in the Quran about Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, coming to Jerusalem and ascending to heaven from the Temple Mount. And on the site where that's thought to have happened, they build a beautiful shrine, which you can still visit today, called the Dome of the Rock, which is that famous golden dome that you see in pictures of Jerusalem. So all of this makes for a very interesting city with a lot of historical layers. It makes for a very beautiful city, and it makes for a city that is a pretty complicated place to live.
We're talking today with Mati Friedman. He is the author of a brand new book, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel, about a ragtag group of young people. I think they're all young men. We'll find out more about the break on that. But they are spies in a brand new country. Join us after the break for more On the Front Porch. Welcome back to On the Front Porch. We're getting our lesson today on the birth of the modern country of Israel and some of its background as well. Mati Friedman is the author of a brand new book that talks about spies in the very early ages of Israel. I don't want to give up too much of the book, but I just want people to appreciate how impossible it was for Israel to survive the war of 1948, and how this ragtag group of spies that you're talking about in your book had to borrow a camera and were the birthplace of the world-renowned intelligence service that Israel has today. Can we go back then to that time, 1948, barely a country, immediately went to war? Can you kind of set us up for what that felt like, what it looked like, and how impossible, and make everybody appreciate how impossible it was that they won?
Right. It's an incredible moment in history. It's just 3 years after the Second World War. The world is still kind of reeling from that war. Certainly the Jewish people, they've lost 6 million people, a big chunk of the Jewish people, almost the entire Jewish population of Europe, has been killed or displaced, and the world is in turmoil. And just 3 years after the end of that war, things come to a head in Palestine. The British, who've ruled the country for about 30 years, declare that they've had it. They're pulling out. They're turning the country over to the United Nations. The United Nations decides that it's going to be divided into two new countries, one for Jews and one for Arabs, and that triggers a war. And on paper, the Jews are vastly outnumbered by the Arab world, and they don't seem to have much of a chance. And the British general staff is betting that the Jews are going to lose, and the British put their money on the Arab side. And the British are funding and leading the Jordanian army, which is called the Arab Legion, and they've kind of placed their placed their bet on the Arab side. And the Jews understand that they have no choice. They have to win. They have nowhere else to go. They can't go back to Europe, and no other country, America included, will take in the masses of refugees that are floating around the world after the Second World War. They have no choice. So one of the things that they do, besides building kind of makeshift weapons, they have makeshift weapons workshops underground in Israel, and they're smuggling in arms from places like Czechoslovakia. They smuggle in old German fighter planes in crates, and they put them together surreptitiously. They bring in people who can fly these planes, a lot of Americans. The early Israeli Air Force in 48 is staffed largely by American World War II veterans who come to help out. So it's this incredible kind of makeshift, desperate operation at the time. And one of the things that they really don't have is intelligence. They don't understand what the other side is thinking, and that's partly because the Jewish population in Palestine at the time is almost entirely East European in origin, so they can't speak Arabic, and they know very little about the Arab side. But the Jews have a very small and, at the time, marginal population of Jewish people with origins in Arab countries, Arabic speakers, people whose culture is Arab, people who can, crucially, pass as Arabs on the other side of the line, people who can cross enemy lines and bring back information. So they pick up a few of these kids, basically street kids. You know, one of the characters in this book was selling green peppers from a crate at a vegetable market in Tel Aviv when he's spotted. And they pick up these kids who are in the country without parents, who really have very little, and they train them to assume Arab identities and go across the line. And that is the beginning of the Arab section, which is the subject of this book, and it's eventually what we know today as the Mossad.
Let's talk about you just a bit. Again, at the beginning of the show, you talked about where you came from. You ended up in Israel, and then morphed that into how you got interested in how you researched this book. You were born and raised in Toronto. I assume you're Jewish.
That's right. I grew up in a traditional Jewish home in Toronto, and always felt a strong connection to Israel. And that when I finished high school, I decided that I wanted to go there for a year to work and learn the language. And as soon as I got there, I knew that it was going to be pretty hard to leave. I loved the country, and it felt right. And I declared that I was going to stay.
And how did your people come to Toronto? Did they come after World War II, or did they come very early, or how did they come to Toronto?
My grandparents came from Eastern Europe, Poland and Ukraine, what is now Ukraine, before the Second World War.
Okay.
So
had they started to see oppression at that time, and they immigrated because of that?
There's a wave, even before the rise of the Nazis, there's a huge wave of Jewish emigration from Eastern Europe because of poverty and oppression and pogroms in Russia. And that's the big wave of immigration that brings the Jewish community to to America. There is a community here before, but it's quite small. But that famous wave of immigration through Ellis Island, people coming to places like New York, people ending up in small towns, often running stores in small towns across America, that immigration begins really at the very end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And things kind of ramp up as World War II gets closer and as the danger to the Jewish people becomes more acute. But by that time, many of the doors are shut, and countries aren't accepting Jewish refugees, and that's one reason that the pressure on Palestine begins to build. These people have nowhere else to go.
So, when you moved to Israel as a young person, did you know these kinds of stories, or how did you come to find out about this and write about this?
Well, actually, I didn't really know about it, and I went to Israel with a fairly simple story about the place, and it was a very European story, which is the one that people tend to know, Theodor Herzl, the guy who founds the modern Zionist movement in Vienna, pogroms in Europe, socialism, the rise of the kibbutz idea, of course, the Holocaust. This is a very European story. People remember characters like David Ben-Gurion and Golda Meir and these great kind of characters of the birth of Israel, all of whom came from Eastern Europe. The problem is that once you're in the country, and again, I encourage everyone to visit, those stories don't explain the country, because the country is a very Middle Eastern place. And that's not just because the country is physically in the Middle East. It's because the Jewish population of Israel is largely Middle Eastern in origin, people who have very little to do with the story of Herzl and the Holocaust and Judaism of Europe. They come from places like Aleppo, Syria, or Baghdad, or Casablanca, Morocco, or Tunis, or Libya, or Yemen, and they have a different story, and they have a different connection to the Islamic world. They're native to the Middle East. They didn't come from anywhere else. And I realized that our stories about Israel need to begin to reflect that. We need stories that explain that aspect of the life of the country, and that is that's one of the main triggers for Spies of No Country. So it's a pretty good spy yarn, and of course like a lot of people, I'm a sucker for a good spy yarn. But what it's really doing, or what it's trying to do, is tell a story about Israel in which the main characters are Jews who didn't come from Europe, but came from the Arab world, and tried to explain how these events looked through their eyes. And I think that if a reader understands that, then the country in 2019 becomes a lot easier to understand.
Well, I don't think a lot of people understand that. And this book is technically fiction, true?
It's nonfiction.
Oh, really? These are real people you're writing about?
It's completely true. I'm a journalist, so I've written three works of nonfiction. It's based on interviews. It's based on some newly declassified documents that I got from the military archive. Very interesting stuff. Radio traffic from 1948 between headquarters in Israel and this very early intelligence station in Beirut. A few of the guys left behind recorded oral testimonies that are very rich in detail, and I've used those. But the book is entirely factual. It's a true story.
I don't think people understand how many thousands of hours of research a book like this takes. How long did it take you to write?
My first interview for this book was in 2011, when I met one of these guys. Now he's 94. He was the last one alive. And I began interviewing him in 2011, not sure how much time I would have with him. He's still alive. And is sharp as a knife, but I wasn't sure in 2011. So that's when the process starts, and it just came out this week in 2019. So I haven't been working on it straight since 2011, but it was a long process of several years of research and writing. It was pretty. It's not a long book, but it was a pretty big research undertaking.
We're going to go to a break. We're visiting today with Mati Friedman. He is the author of a new book, Spies of No Country, Secret Lives at the Birth of Israel. We've been talking about the history of the Israeli people, the birth of the country, and specifically that time between 1948 and 1968, and the evolution of the country and how that country has come about. Join us after the break for more on the Front Porch. Welcome back to the final segment of On the Front Porch. It's my pleasure and honor today to be visiting with Matee Friedman, a native of Toronto, Canada, who moved to Israel as a young person, has written for a number of newspapers around the world. Let's talk about that just a little bit, Matee. Your background prior to now, between the time you went to college and now, where all have you written and where have you written from?
Well, I've been writing from Jerusalem for quite a while. I began writing for an English language news magazine called the Jerusalem Report. And then I moved to the AP Bureau in Jerusalem, the Associated Press, the big U.S. news agency. And I worked there for about 5.5 years as a correspondent and editor on their Jerusalem desk until the very end of 2011. And then I decided to strike out on my own, and I wrote my first book, nonfiction book, called The Aleppo Codex, which is about the most important copy of the Bible in Hebrew. And it's kind of strange journey from a safe in a little grotto in the city of Aleppo into the chaos of the Middle East in the middle of the 20th century, where it disappears and resurfaces and is smuggled across borders and is partially stolen. That's the story of the Aleppo Codex. That was my first book. The second book is called Pumpkin Flowers, and it's a military memoir about a strange guerrilla war that I blundered into in the late 90s as a soldier in an infantry unit of the Israeli army. It's about our outpost, which was called Outpost Pumpkin, and that war in many ways foreshadows, I think, the American engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's one of the things that makes it interesting. And now there's this book, Spies of No Country, and in my spare time I write fairly regularly for the New York Times op-ed section. I do some journalism here and there, and I have 4 kids under the age of 11, and that takes up what time is left.
So I have not been to Israel. Actually, a group from our church just got back here in the last month. So there are a lot of Americans that go to Israel as, I'll call them, religious tourists, if that's my made-up term. But Israel, living in Israel in your adulthood, has the feel of Israel changed? Has it become less of a feel of imperil? Quite honestly, as growing up, you used to be shelled off the Golan Heights. You had that short war with Egypt. There was always a when we heard on the news of terrorists and terrorism and bombers. But it seems that in more recent years, it's become less, I guess I'll say militarized, that's a bad word, less daily bombarded.
I think that's true. Living in Israel is a very strange feeling because in many ways the country is doing great. And it's booming in many ways. There's a lot of prosperity there, which is new. When I came to Israel in the mid-1990s, you couldn't get Nike shoes and there was no Gap. And it felt like kind of a poor place. And now if you go to Tel Aviv, it feels like the hippest European city you've ever been in. So in many ways, the country is just kind of rolling forward and doing great. But there is, there's an existential threat that is always in the back of people's mind. People are worried about the rise of Iran. Iran now has proxies on our border with Lebanon and our border with Syria, and Iran is involved with Hamas in Gaza. So Israelis are worried about, the region around us, which is still hostile, and we're reminded of that fairly regularly by rockets fired from Gaza into Israel and by smaller terror attacks here and there. But in general, the situation in Israel is much, much more stable than it was, for example, when I was a university student between 2000 and 2003, which was a time when there were suicide bombings almost every week. The Israeli military has really brought that under control, and people live in Israel quite safely most of the time. If you look at the statistics, you'll see that Israel is actually safer than most American cities. So it's a complicated place. Sometimes we feel safe, and sometimes we feel threatened, and sometimes we think everything's going to be okay, and sometimes people freak out about the future, and that's just part of the kind of potent mix of life in the state of Israel.
Certainly in my lifetime, those were all the things that I saw. And I also saw Israel rise up to a point that they had the manufacturing capabilities to do a lot of things themselves that they had to import before. I was glad you told the story about the 1948 war, about bringing in airplanes from Europe and then bringing in pilots from the United States. Then you mentioned earlier that in the 67 war, the Israelis were flying French airplanes. At some point, though, after 67, it appears the United States got on board as being a ally of Israel.
That's right. After 67, when Israel proves itself as a military power, the alliance between Israel and the United States really takes off. And by 1973, when there's another war, Israel's attacked, Israel suffers a surprise attack on two fronts from Egypt and from Syria. And by that point, the Americans are active in helping the Israelis. There's a huge shipment of arms to Israel during the war to help the Israelis out. And since then, there's been a very close relationship between the United States and Israel, some of which is visible, and much of which is invisible in the world of intelligence cooperation and things like that. It's a very interesting and very, very close relationship, although it's one that's become politically charged in America, as everything has become politically charged. But if you go to Israel, you'll find that you probably won't visit a more pro-American country. People love the United States. People are grateful for American support, and America and Americans are popular in Israel in a way that they're not in a lot of the rest of the world.
I early set your book up as the, if you will, the birthplace or how the modern day Israel's Mossad got started. Was that fair or correct?
Yes, it is. The Arab section was one of the seeds of the Mossad. There are others. But certainly the spies in this story, three of the four, one of them dies, and the other three continue to careers in the Mossad. The mastermind of the Arab section, the guy who's running it before 1948, becomes a very important figure in the Israeli intelligence world. He runs Israel's most famous spy. There's a guy named Eli Cohen who manages to penetrate the highest levels of the Syrian regime in the 60s before he's caught and he's hung in Damascus in 1965. So these people ended up being central, and the talents that they showed in 1948 and the experience they acquired in 1948 is an important part of how the Israeli intelligence system is created.
I hope I don't sneak up on you with this question, but I'm interested, as you researched the book and put all this together, what was the thing that surprised you the most, or was the biggest aha, or the biggest, oh my goodness, I can't believe that moment or fact that you ran onto as you were researching the book?
Sure. The spies, a small group of them, are inserted into the Arab world at the height of the fighting in 1948. They end up in Beirut, and they have no way to communicate. So, you know, this great spy service, which we all think of as, you know, incredibly advanced and sophisticated, sent guys off into the Arab world with absolutely no way to talk to headquarters. They didn't have a radio. They didn't own a radio. They couldn't send mail because the borders had been cut. So there they are in Beirut in the spring of 1948. Arab armies are invading Israel at its birth, and these guys don't know if the state has survived. They don't know if they're spying for a country that exists or no longer exists. And all they have is headlines that they're reading in Arabic newspapers claiming that the Arab armies have eradicated this new Jewish state. And they have no idea if it's true or not because they have no way to contact home. So for a few weeks in the spring of 1948, they really are spies of no country. They have no idea if this project is going to work. So it's not like being a spy for the CIA, which I imagine is very difficult and frightening, but you know that America exists. You know Langley exists. You know that if you get in trouble, there's someone who can help you. These guys had none of that. They didn't have Langley, and they didn't have a country, and that uncertainty was really, really strange. striking to me.
Well, I think we want to tell everyone once again about your three books, because they seem like they have a similar tenor to them. And so your first book, your second, and then this one, again, just a short synopsis and the name of them.
Sure. The first one is the Aleppo Codex, which traces, it's a nonfiction mystery, which traces the fate of the most important copy of the Bible in Hebrew, which is also called the Aleppo Codex. The second one is called Pumpkin Flowers, and it's about a small group of soldiers holding an outpost inside Lebanon in a war against Hezbollah in the 90s, a war that foreshadows the wars of the 21st century in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And this third book is called Spies of No Country, and it's about four very young amateur agents who ended up helping create the State of Israel in 1948.
You've been listening today to Mati Friedman. He is an author, of course, and resident of Israel, and we have learned a great deal about the background of Israel and what has made it strong today. Join us every day at this time for more On the Front Porch.